It's pledge season on Slate Podcasts. If you love Mom and Dad Are Fighting, you can help support it by joining Slate Plus at slate.com/fightingplus. We'll be talking about it more later in the show.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for October 5th, the full brony edition. I'm Gabriel Roth, an editor at Slate and the father of Eliza, age 6, and Leo, who is 3.
And I am Carvel Wallace, a writer and editor out in the Bay Area, and I'm the father of Georgia, who is 12, and Ezra, who is 14.
Rebecca Lavoie can't be with us this week because she is sick, supposedly. Get better soon, Rebecca, if indeed you are sick. Today on our show, Slate writer Aisha Harris will be joining us to tackle a question from a listener whose daughter wants an American Girl doll that doesn't look like her, and another from a listener who's wondering how to divide up her estate among her two children and what to do with all of the excess wealth that she plans to leave behind. Plus, as always, we'll have triumphs and fails, recommendations, and on Slate Plus, Aisha will tell us a little bit about why she's committed to remaining child-free for life and never joining the target audience of this podcast. First up, we've got triumphs and fails. Carvel, how's your week been? Was it a triumph week or a fail week?
Oh, man. We had, I don't know if this is a triumph or a fail, but it's something I would like to know other people's opinions on. So the story goes that my daughter has this friend who is not one of her long-term friends, but one of the friends that she made when she started middle school a year and a half ago. And this friend of hers, they're close, there's sleepovers, there's hangouts, there's walking together after school, that sort of thing. Her mother and I have always been a little bit on the fence about this kid, whatever. She might be kind of an asshole. I don't know. But whatever. My daughter likes her, so fine. She's cool. So she hangs out. And then this weekend, I'm overhearing my daughter on the phone with this friend. And she's like using the friend's name before every sentence, which is clearly the sign of some kind of conflict arising between these two girls. And she doesn't talk to me about it. She doesn't mention anything. And then later in the day, her mother pulls me aside and says, "Hey, can I ask your opinion on something?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Here's the situation." So she explained that Friday of last week, my daughter and this friend after school were at the Trader Joe's across the street from their school. There's this grocery store across the street from the school. Kids go over there, buy snacks, hang out, whatever. They're goofing around in the grocery store. My daughter bumps into her friend who's holding her phone. Her friend's phone drops. The glass shatters. So there is then frustration between the two of them. The phone is broken, etc. So apparently this friend thinks that my daughter should pay for it or pay some portion of it for it. I don't think she should pay for it. Her mother doesn't think she should pay for it. Even this girl's parents, the other girl, from what we've heard, don't think that she should pay for it. Because as far as we're all concerned, it's a phone drop. Like, you get a kid a phone, sometimes the phone's going to drop. That's part of what happens. You pay to get the screen repaired. It's not cheap, but it's just one of the things that comes with the territory of kids having phones. But my daughter and this friend are in this conflict about whether or not she should pay for it. And my daughter is leaning towards paying for it. So first she comes to us and is like, "Can you give me money to pay for this kid's phone?" And we're like, "No, I don't think so." And one of the things her mother asked me advice for was like, "Should I reach out to this girl's parents and see?" And we sort of decided, no, if they want money from us, they can call us and try to be assholes about it. But I don't think they're going to do that because no adult thinks that like the one kid should pay for the other kid's phone because it was an accident. Like, it'd be different if she burst into the room, smashed the phone with a hammer and then ran out. Then we'd have to pay for it. But it was natural accident. But my daughter feels really, really responsible and wants to pay for the phone. So we're like, "Well, we're not giving you money to pay for this." So what my daughter decided was that she was going to take some of her saved money, money, and use basically about $100 of it.
This is
no
good.
And just give it to this kid to pay for the phone.
This is no good.
It's no good. And we're like, you can't do that. But she's like, "It's my money." But I'm like, "Yeah, but she's like, but this is my money. You told me if it's my money, I can do what I want with it." And I'm like, "Yeah, but not this." And she's like, "But it's my money." And her mother and I were at a dead end. And we were both like, "Well, I'll tell you what. We really think this is a bad idea. We really think that your friend is being kind of an asshole. We really think she's not that great a friend." And my daughter was like, "I agree. She's not that great a friend, but I do feel responsible for this. I'm going to give her the money. And then I hope our relationship is over because I actually don't like her anymore." And so we were like, I don't know what to do. Hands in the air. Like, it is your money. Like, you've saved this money. Like, this is your money. If this is what you want to do with it. And she did. She gave the kid $100 of her cash. And then that's it.
All right. I'll tell you what I think.
Yeah, here's what I think. Yeah, tell me what you think.
Here's what I think. At first, I thought where this story was going was she needed to pay the friend money as a kind of friendship ransom. That, like, the friend was holding her amity, her affection in reserve until
yes.
she was made whole on this phone.
This is what we thought, too. Yes.
And Georgia is like, I need this friendship so badly. I need to maintain this friendship with this girl. It's so important to me to maintain this friendship that I'm willing to spend $100 of my own money just in order to keep this friendship alive, which that is bad. That's no
yes.
good at all.
That's terrible. That's that's codependent. That's problematic on every possible level.
Right. On the other hand, given what she said to you at the end, where she said, you know, I want to give her the money and then I hope we never talk to each other again, that suggests that what she needs is a kind of moral high ground in order to successfully extricate herself from the relationship.
Hmm.
And she needs to prevent the friend from being able to say, oh, well, Georgia broke my phone and then wouldn't pay for it. And that's why we're not friends anymore. She's willing
right.
to pay $100 to prevent that situation from happening, and then she can leave the friendship as the person who did the right thing, holds her head high, and yet, fuck you.
Yes. Yeah. So it's interesting because both of these behaviors, if you ask me personally, are a little bit codependent. Because on the one hand, like if we thought, like when we thought that she was using the money to buy the friendship, that's obviously problematic. But on the other hand, this idea that she couldn't rest until she had negotiated the moral high ground, even though she already had it. So she knew she had the moral high ground. She also knew that all of the mutual friends agreed that she had the moral high ground. Like, there was not a friend in their friend group that was like, yeah, Georgia should pay for this. Everyone was like, yeah, I don't think this is Georgia's fault. But Georgia was uncomfortable with the fact that there was one person who thought that she didn't have the moral high ground, and she wanted to negotiate for that.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing to me is very interesting. The parenting fail is that we were unable to talk her out of this. Like, we would ideally want to be able to say, look, if this person thinks that you owe her money for the phone and she's going to have a problem about that, that's her fucking problem. Like, that doesn't have anything to do with you. But we couldn't get her to adopt that point of view. She felt compelled and she felt involved and she felt like she had to do something about it. And so she parted with her money.
Well, this is a parenting fail in the category of sometimes they have to make their own mistakes, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I, on the other hand...
What about you? Tell us about your fail or triumph.
I have a triumph, and it's an unequivocal triumph, frankly. I successfully pitched and received the assignment at Slate Magazine to write the review of the forthcoming motion picture, My Little Pony, the movie. And as a result of negotiating that assignment
yes.
for myself, I was able to obtain two tickets to the critics preview of My Little Pony, the movie, at the Empire Theater in Times Square, AMC Empire in Times Square. And so Eliza and I went to see it on Sunday morning. And I think I'm still under embargo, but I think the day this podcast comes out, the embargo will be over. So my review will be published tomorrow. Spoiler, it's pretty good. But I can also say that taking a six-year-old kid to be like the first person in America to see the My Little Pony movie at the special theater in Times Square where they give you free popcorn and free soda is a parenting triumph. Weirdly, like, I would buy her a popcorn anyway. If we went to the movies, I would like get her some popcorn. But the fact that we got the popcorn for free,
thanks to
my elevated role as cinema critic, was extreme. The whole thing was extremely thrilling and exciting for her, and we had a good time.
No, yeah, there is absolutely no angle from which this is not an incredible triumph. I bow down to you because not only does America get one of our greatest minds on the greatest cinematic adventure of the earliest part of the 21st century. You also get the opportunity to be the man, capital T, capital M, the man who has the access, the backstage pass. You push aside the rainbow curtains. You bring your daughter directly to the nerve center of My Little Pony. I mean, this is powerful stuff, Gabe. You should You should be very proud of yourself.
I really am. I mean, imagine when the movie appears and the kids are talking about going to see it, she'll be able to say, "Oh, I already saw that," in a slightly bored way. What greater triumph could there possibly be?
There is none.
So, all right.
Talking about money can be so hard, especially when the person you're talking to is still learning how to do long division. That's why Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace, is here to help. I'm Bridget, and with my fellow co-host Ryan, we help teach your little ones about complex topics like bankruptcy, climate change, and why there's so much gold at Fort Knox, and so much more. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's your Mom and Dad Are Fighting hosts, and it's still pledge season here. If you've heard us talking about joining Slate Plus for 3 weeks, you have probably gotten a little annoyed with these pledge segments by now, but we have something to offer that public radio pledge drives cannot offer, which is when you sign up for Slate Plus, you will never hear the pledge drive again. If you're driving in your car listening to public radio and they're doing a pledge drive and you're annoyed, you can give them money, but the radio is still doing the pledge drive.
Ouch.
That's the great advantage of podcasting right there, is that if you sign up for Slate Plus, if you had signed up for Slate Plus, you would be listening to content right now instead of this pledge drive segment, because you'd be getting ad-free, pledge drive-free, extended versions of all your favorite Slate shows, including this one. Rebecca, why else should they sign up for Slate Plus at slate.com/momanddadplus?
Well, it's totally affordable. It's just $35 for the first year at slate.com/momanddadplus. It's very easy to do there. My favorite thing is that the Slate Plus content just comes right to my podcast app. I don't have to do anything to get it. It's very, very easy to set up and do. Also, we get to win a contest if we sign up more Slate Plus members than any other Slate podcast. And you can win a contest, lucky listener. You could get a voicemail. And there's something in it for you, a prize potentially. One lucky winner will get a voicemail from the podcast host of their choice. So maybe your spouse or your best friend is a huge fan of a Slate podcast. Join Slate Plus. And if you win, you could surprise them with a cheery greeting from a podcaster that you love. We all know on this show you would choose Carvel. Well, that's okay with me. Just sign up, please, for Slate Plus at slate.com/momanddadplus. Carvel, I know that you think there are also compelling reasons to do this, right?
Yeah, but first I want to give you my voicemail voice. It's going to sound like this. Hi, you've reached insert name here. Unfortunately, I can't come to the phone right now. Just as a little sample of what you're going to get. Really excited about that. I think there are a lot of good reasons for joining. There are a lot of good reasons for joining Slate Plus. The thing that is most important to me is that probably not a day goes by that I don't read journalism on Slate and go, wow, I'm really glad that someone is reporting on this. And being a writer myself and a journalist myself, I know how much time it takes to write and research and factually sort of organize these articles that let people know what's happening. And that stuff costs time and money. And one of the ways that's funded is by people signing up for Slate Plus to hear the extended versions of the podcast. And like, that reporting is really important right now. This is a really important time to have that. And one of the ways you can contribute to that is by signing up at slate.com/momanddadplus. And the second thing I love is just getting the uninterrupted, unfiltered, unmitigated content, no ads, no interruptions, delivered straight to my podcast app. I love that. That's like next level stuff. So if you want to take your podcast listening to the next level, you want to stop playing around in the kiddie pool, get in with the grownups, slate.com/momanddadplus.
Great. All right. Thank you, guys. That's it for pledge season. If you haven't joined Slate Plus yet, one last chance, slate.com/momanddadplus. Help us make these shows. Help us win the contest. Back to the show. Okay. For our first question, we have a special guest. Slate staff writer Aisha Harris is with us today because we have a question about an American Girl doll. And Aisha wrote in September of last year a terrific piece called The Making of an American Girl about Addie Walker, the first African-American American Girl doll. And first, let's hear Lisa's question, and then we'll talk to Aisha.
Hi. My name is Lisa, and I'm calling with a question about American Girl dolls. I have a 6-year-old daughter who has expressed interest in an American Girl doll. She isn't much of a doll person, so I was a little bit surprised. I don't love American Girl dolls, but I like that they come in a variety of shades and ethnicities. So I asked my daughter if she wanted a doll that looked like her, and she responded, no, I want a blonde doll. I have blonde hair and blue eyes, and my husband is Vietnamese. Therefore, my daughter looks Vietnamese with brown eyes, brown hair. With one small answer, she has cast a big shadow on how well I've done with educating her about beauty standards, as well as about pride in her heritage and her race. In the last year, my daughter has told me twice that she wishes she had blonde hair. And when she says this, I try not to panic, but my responses are weak, usually along the lines of, you're perfect just how you are. I've tried to draw her out a little on the issue, but she isn't very interested. She goes to a school that is 60% white, but there aren't many Asian, much less Vietnamese people there. My husband grew up in a as part of the only Asian family in a small white town. He doesn't feel it harmed him in any way, and he doesn't have much guidance on the issue. So, with these questions, I wonder if I get my daughter the doll she wants. If I get her the doll that looks like her, can I make it fun for her and not feel like a punishment? Or do I not buy her a doll at all? Am I making too big a deal out of this? On a practical note, these are very pricey dolls, so I want the purchase to be worth it. I love the show. I listen every week, and I would really appreciate your insights. Thank you.
So, Aisha, before we get to concrete suggestions for Lisa, tell us a little bit, what is, for listeners who don't know, what are American Girl dolls? And tell us a little bit about the piece you wrote last year.
Yeah, American Girl dolls came into prominence in the 80s. It was started by Pleasant Roland, a woman from the Midwest, and she essentially wanted to create this series of dolls that were not just dolls that you would want to play with, but dolls that also had a backstory to them, a narrative, and they all coincided with a point in time in history. So you had one doll whose backstory was she was a from like the frontier, the plains. I think she was set in like the 17th century, 16th or 17th century. You had Molly. She was from around like the World War II era, I believe. I'm trying to remember all of these. there were quite a few. And then, but they kind of blossomed into even more than just these stories. Now they have dolls where you can create your own doll that looks like you. So you can, they have like a variety of shades, variety of different hairstyles and haircuts. They even have some dolls for kids who might have disabilities, so to make them look like them. So it's a big empire. It's a huge empire. They have stores, flagship stores in different cities across the country. And they were a big part of my life as a child, and a big part of a lot of other girls' lives. And they seem to be still very big 20, 25 years later. I'm almost 30 now. So they're a very big deal. And I can understand this question and how important it is to have a doll that looks like you, because that was very much emphasized in my household with my parents.
What did your parents do, and what kind of doll did you have?
Yeah, so in the article that I wrote, it was about the making of Addie. Addie Walker was the first black doll that the company introduced, and her backstory was that she was a slave, or at least in the first book. It comes with a series of books, each character. And in the first book, she starts off as a slave, and then the rest of the series is about her making her way to freedom and, you know, winding up living her life and having her family reunited after they run away. But in my household, my dad especially was very adamant. There were no white dolls in our house. Like, it was never going to happen, even though I definitely wanted some of the white dolls and even white Barbies. That was never going to happen. And so I learned to deal with it. And I think in some ways it was, I'm glad my parents did it. At the same time, there was only so much my dad and my mom could do. And I still definitely felt as though black was not as desirable as a white doll.
Yeah. I mean, So I have a daughter who is now 11 and is, or 12 rather, and who is mostly, I would say, out of the doll phase. But when we were younger, this was an issue that came up. My daughter is biracial. It sort of was clear to all of us that all the media taken as a whole, television, movies, songs, music, cartoons, dolls, toys, all tended towards a particular standard of white beauty that my daughter felt like didn't match her personal experience. And so I guess probably the one thing with the first thing, I don't know yet what I actually think about whether or not they should get the doll or which doll. I can see both sides and I'll explore that later. But the one thing I want to do first for this parent is kind of absolve her from the personal responsibility she feels that, like, this is a sign that she's done a bad job, right? This is a six-year-old kid who is receiving messages from a wide spectrum of sources. And that's the thing about being a parent, is that you bring this kid into the world and you think I think we have a tendency to overestimate our influence and dominion. Like, we create everything and everything that we, and so anything they do is a result of us, but it's not really like that. They come with their own stuff, and we also share them with the world, and the world gets to them in ways that we can't possibly be expected to shield or protect or prevent. And that's what it sounds like has happened here to some extent. And, I also think that the mother has described herself as having blonde hair and blue eyes. I don't think it's unusual for a child to want a doll that looks like her mother, the primary female role model in her life. I don't think that that's necessarily even a sign of something, sinister, some kind of, like, I don't even know that that's the case. I think it's a very complex issue, and I can sort of see both sides to it, but I wonder, Aisha, I know that you don't have kids, but I wonder... You said that you were raised in this way, and I totally relate to that. That's kind of how I came up too, but would you do the same with your kids?
Yeah, I think I would, just because I do think that we have so many representations of whiteness being the default, of it being exalted. And even, like, yes, we have today, we have Beyonce, we have Rihanna, but you know, they are also lighter skinned Black people. And there's not as much, I still think that there is colorism that exists. I think that, if your kid is going to be seeing this outside of the home, everywhere else, like, the one place it could not happen would be in your household. So I would personally want to make sure, you know, if I had all the money in the world, maybe I would get them several dolls so that they could have all the dolls they want. But I don't think that's necessarily, that's not the answer. And this listener, obviously, like, she mentions, like, she wants to make this purchase and not have to buy, or she implies that she doesn't want to have to buy more than one. So I would say it would be, I would myself make sure that they had a Black doll, a doll that looked like them.
Is there a danger if you do that, that the feelings of disappointment and resentment that attach themselves to the doll for not getting the doll they want, does that become a whole bunch of complex stuff for them to deal with? I just feel like this is an extremely difficult and perhaps impossible problem.
I just say, from my own kids who are now 14 and 12, I don't think so. I think, you know, one of the things I think is really interesting about the way people talk about race in the home is that you kind of have to go all the way or nothing, right? So, like, what happens, I think, is a lot of people try to, like, sort of kind of address race, but not really address it. And that's where kids fill in the blanks with all kinds of resentments and, like, oh, I'm forced to do this thing, but it doesn't make any sense why, and what's this about, and so on and so forth. I think that as a parent, if I were to say to my daughter, for example, no, you can only have dolls that have this color hair or this kind of skin or whatever, and sort of just explain, oh, vaguely, like, oh, we want a doll that looks like you, and that's the end of it, I think that that wouldn't be a satisfactory explanation for her. I think that that in order for her to understand that, what I've, particularly this has fallen on me as the Black parent, I think their mom has been as fully supportive as she possibly can be. And she's also acknowledged that there's a limit to how much she can support. Just like there's some stuff with my daughter that I recognize there's a limit to how much I can support her with, that her mother supports her with. But for me as a parent, I feel pretty strongly that I have to lay out to my kids the entire spectrum of this situation, so that as they gain consciousness, and that's the other thing, is that you're looking at kids as a longitudinal project. So, like, starting at six, they might not get all of it, but you're building foundations. And as they get older, they begin to understand. So as they grow, like, I'm finding that my kids have a much more complex understanding of how race and colorism and classism and all those things work in a sort of 360 degree context, how it's systemic, how it's subconscious, how there's implicit bias without people knowing it, where they fit into that, what they carry, et cetera. But I think you have to explain and or be willing to represent for all that stuff as a parent the whole way through so that your kids actually do understand. Because if you sort of, and this is something I see a lot in the Bay Area, if you sort of go, oh, we just think that this is the right thing to do, but you don't want to get too deep into explaining why, then yeah, kids do go, well, this sounds like a bunch of bullshit. And then they try to fill in the blank or get resentful or even worse, try to rebel, which ends up wasting a lot of time over a kid's life. So I think that this parent has to kind of be willing to have much more complicated and difficult conversations about it, even conversations that, and I think my kid's mom is, I've watched her do this and it's really impressive to me, even conversations that implicate her in the existence of systemic racism.
I think that's a great point, because I will say that it wasn't just like my parents were like, no, you're not going to have a white doll. They explained to me, even as young as six, why I couldn't have a white doll. I mean, granted, my dad also like showed me Roots when I was 8 years old, and I was probably too young to process that. But I do think it's very important to have these conversations. I don't think 6 years old is too young to start having them. And it's not going to be the same conversation you would have with a 10-year-old, but I do think it's important. And she mentioned that they have a very small Asian population in the town she's in, but I do think like maybe there's some sort of community that you can try to find for her to have and for her to experience, because I do think it is important. While her dad may have grown up in the same sort of environment, I do think being a boy and being a girl is different. Growing up in that kind of environment, they have very different experiences. And he might have been fine, but I think girls have it much harder, especially girls of color in that kind of environment. So I do think there, like, it would be worth seeking out some sort of, and I'm not saying go out and find a random Asian person and ask them to be like your child's mentor, but, you know, expose her in some ways. Like, and that means putting yourself in an uncomfortable situation too, maybe if you're not used to being around so many Asian people. But I do think it's important. Like, immersion is very crucial, especially at that young an age.
Something that Aisha said just reminded me that this is something that I think comes up a lot, at least from what I've observed, when white parents are raising children of color, is that that last thing Aisha said about having to put yourself in an uncomfortable position, I think that right there is the crux of it. And we live in a world in which whiteness is a kind of assumed to be a comfortable default. And so when kids of color are in white families, and I actually had this experience myself growing up for some years, which is a whole nother story, that the assumption is that, well, for the white parents, is like, we live in a mostly white world. It's the world is white. And my kid of color is just folded in and it's all good and everything is fine. But that's really that's fine for everyone except for that kid who's really uncomfortable. And so, you know, to sign up to raise a child of color, whether that's through adoption or through interracial marriage or what have you, means that in order to do it right, I believe and have observed over these many years that it requires white parents to put themselves in a situation where they are the minority, where they have to be in spaces and be in spaces where they are no longer the default. That is an important thing, and I think more parents need to be willing to do that.
All right. Aisha Harris, thanks so much for being with us. Aisha is the host of Slate's Represent podcast and a staff writer at Slate. She'll be back in our Slate Plus segment. Lisa, I hope that was helpful to you. Give us a call back. Let us know what you decide and how it goes. Okay, moving on. Our next question is from Katie.
Hi, my name is Katie, and a lot of times you get questions that are not fun. This is kind of a fun question. My husband and I are really fortunate and have been very fortunate in our business, and we have kind of a significant inheritance to leave to our kids if we were to die. And so I've been thinking a lot about this question as we're writing up wills. What do I leave to my kids, and what do I leave to charity? I recognize that too much money, especially too early, can really ruin a kid. And so I'm trying to come up with really specific instructions to give to the executor of my will, and my husband's will, if the worst should happen. It's both a scary thing to think about, but also kind of fun. What do you pay for? Do you match a down payment on a house? When do you give them the bulk of the money? what do you expect that they're going to fail at and what do you hope they're going to succeed at? In any case, we're talking about $1 million per child. So lucky, lucky kids. And I look forward to hearing what you have to say. Thanks so much.
That is a fun question. And beyond a fun question, it's a question that gets at some very profound and complicated things about ethics and morality, because there's two sides to that, right? There's the side that's about what's best for your kids, and there's the side that's about the rest of the world. We're talking about a division of assets between the heirs and a philanthropic bequest, a charitable donation. And if you ask, like, what should I do? How much should I leave to my kids and how much should I leave to charity? Well, if we think of the word should as connoting a moral imperative, then the answer is probably that you should leave it to the people who need it most, which probably isn't your children. And, you know, I it's hard in a way to justify a society that's built like ours so much on inherited wealth. Even though you can come up with justifications for some forms of inequality, inherited wealth is the kind of equality that's the hardest to justify, and the disparities in inherited wealth are the hardest to really reconcile with any notion of a fair or just society. At the same time, having said that, I should acknowledge that I got a moderate inheritance from my grandparents, and I used it when I was in my 20s to take some time when I didn't have to make money, and I went to graduate school and wrote a novel, and that was very, formative and productive, and my life wouldn't be where it is. I would be much less happy than I am today if I hadn't had the ability to do that. So for me to come out against inherited wealth there's obviously an element of hypocrisy there. In terms of what I think the caller is really asking about, which is how much wealth would be good for my children to inherit. That's complicated. We all know that there's kids who inherit too much money and it spoils them and their lives are ruined by it. And they never have to figure out how to make their way in the world or what they are able to do or how they can contribute. And then presumably there are also people who inherit large amounts of money for whom it's a wonderful thing and they get to be great scholars and philanthropists. In terms of what's good for your kids, it's certainly good for them to be able to go to college and come out of college without any student loans. And presumably there's some amount of money beyond that before we get to the point where you're spoiling them. But a lot of this obviously has to do with who the kids are and how responsible they are and how you think that they handle that kind of circumstance, and also how old they are when you die, right? Are you going to die when they're teenagers and experience a great tragedy, or are you going to die when they're in middle age and the course of their lives is basically set, and your money can help sort of insulate them from tragedy? So a lot of difficult questions. I do think, in terms of wanting to do what's best for your kids, I think the fact that I think your kids are lucky in a number of ways. They're lucky because you have enough money to give them an inheritance, but they're also lucky because presumably they're growing up in a financially stable home, and they're lucky because they have parents who care about them enough to think about them and ask questions of a parenting podcast. And like, that level of concern makes them much, much luckier than many children in the world. And that while I can understand that worrying about the precise allocation of resources after your death is in a way a fun thing to think about, I think your kids probably benefit from other forms of attention maybe more than that. What do you think, Carvel?
This is a hard question, obviously. And because it gets to all kinds of complex issues having to do with how much money is the amount of money the person should have. And it really, what I think is the real heart beating underneath this question has to do with income inequality and how crazy it is that we cooperate in the same society, but some of us randomly have money to start with and other people have nothing to start with. And yet we're kind of finding ourselves supposed to be competing on the same level. And I think that's very uncomfortable for everyone. As a person who personally has had little to nothing thus far, certainly nothing in the way of inheritance, I don't know if my kids will have anything in the way of inheritance. It seems like that could be a possibility given the way things are going, but that certainly is not our family tradition. But I also was able to go to a fairly expensive school on a scholarship. And so I was around a lot of kids who had all kinds of money that just was always there. And I could never figure out where it was coming from. And that has been a lot of the social circles that I've operated in over the course of my life. So actually, when this question was first asked, I literally had no idea. But now that I've heard Gabe gamely struggle with it, something has become pretty clear to me, which is that there is a threshold beyond which money does and doesn't matter, actually. And someone I know who is in the inheritor or heritrix, whatever you call it, the recipient of a huge fortune. I mean, the kind of fortune that name on the side of a collegiate building kind of fortune. This person that I know once told me that money doesn't matter for everything, but it matters for a lot of things. And as I've watched her over the last 14 years raise her kids and operate her life kind of next to ours, it's become clear to me that there is a real threshold at which it matters that you have a certain amount of income or money setting, and there's a point at which it doesn't make you happy. And I actually think Gabe hinted at it, that the threshold is this. If you're able to, for some years of your life, 1 or 2 years, particularly in your young adulthood, if you have the freedom to pursue something that you care about, that is important, that you love, that you need to build a foundation in, but that doesn't necessarily pay the bills, that's the dividing point right there. Because when I was 19, 20, 21 years old, I could not do that. Like there was no income. There was no rent paid. I just lived in New York and I had to figure out how to make every single dollar that I had to make starting at about 17, 18 years old. And in that time, my peers were building foundations in things because they had a couple of years to play, like 2 or 3 years to kind of figure out what they want to do and travel a little bit and like maybe start some projects that needed a little bit of seed investment, but that weren't going to make any money, but then we're going to turn into actual media things. And some people I know even have made what you might term a small media empire at this point now that we're in our 40s. And I can directly trace that back to the time that they had in our early 20s when I was like working at Starbucks and as a bike messenger and as a telephone fundraiser for United Jewish Appeal Federation. While I was doing that, they were starting film festivals that are now major things. So here's what I think. If you want practical advice, here's my advice. Leave your kids enough money that they can, for 2 years, not have to worry about paying rent. Donate the rest to charity. That's it.
That's pretty good. I like that my own personal good fortune has become a model for the rest of the world. I definitely
yeah,
can endorse that.
Because there is a certain kind of balance that is to be struck. Because, yeah, I mean, I also know some people who had unlimited inheritance and unlimited money to the point where they never had to do anything. And I'm going to be honest and say some of those people I met were, and I mean this honestly, some of the most consistently miserable and unhappy people I've ever met. So this idea, and I think we all know this, but it bears repeating because we're not told this enough, I don't think. The idea that if you had all the money in the world, which I've known people who have, that would somehow make you happy, that has not been what I've seen in the world. I've seen that people who have all the money in the world can still be incredibly unhappy and feel useless and without direction and depressed. And so I do think having too much money can very much be a problem. I also think that people need to know how to make their way in the world. And I think it's hard to do that if your way is kind of already made. Certainly there are exceptions to that rule, but I think the vast majority of people whose ways are already made have a hard time knowing how to make their own way. But I do think those 2 or 3 years is super valuable. I want my kids to have that. I wish I had that. And so I think if you have the opportunity to give that to your kids, you should do it, but you should really calculate what it is just for those 2 years. And obviously they wouldn't see that money until they were, you know, maybe 18 or 21, depending on, you know, how you want to frame it.
Yeah. I mean, of course you don't want to leave $1 million to a 10-year-old. although it could be the premise of quite a good film, a comedy film.
I was going to say, hilarity would ensue.
It really would. I want to say one other thing about the philanthropy aspect of this, because whatever money doesn't go to the kids apparently goes to charity. The one thing I want to say about philanthropy is don't wait until you're dead to do it. Mm. Like, there's the sort of default way of doing these things, and that seems to be the way the caller is thinking of things, is to accumulate as much wealth as you can over the course of your life, and then when you're dead, then you give some sizable part of it away. And that's great to give some sizable part of it away when you're dead, but people need that money now. And you know, rather than just accumulating as much as you can and deferring the moment when you give it away, make that part of your part of the way you do your accounting and your accumulation and your life right now, and show your kids that you're doing it, and like just make it a practice.
Yeah, really good. I agree with that.
All right. Hope that's been helpful. All right. Time now for recommendations. Carvel, what are you going to recommend?
This is actually a recommendation inspired, Gabe, by a Martin Waddell book. Last week, you recommended Owl Babies by Martin Waddell. And I was like, I really love Martin Waddell. And I was like, that name is super familiar. What was the book that we used to read when our kids were little, tiny, little things? And I remembered what it was. It was the all-time classic, Can't You Sleep, Little Bear, by Martin Waddell, which is one of our favorite books. In fact, I was inspired to go back and re-look at it. And we literally just got rid of it early this summer in like, you know, an early, you know, a sort of late spring purge, house purge. And it was on top of a stack of books for a long time that we had been meaning to get rid of. And, you know, so it was fresh in my mind. But this is such a great little book. It's a book about two bears, a father and a baby bear that we think is a boy. I don't know. And they're in a cave, and the little bear tries to sleep, but he's very concerned about the darkness. So the father keeps bringing more lights into the thing, and the father's trying to read his book, and the little bear keeps coming out. He can't sleep, and he needs more light, and he needs more light, and he needs more light, until eventually he's all lit up, and he still can't sleep. And so then the father takes him in his arms and takes him outside and shows him the stars and lets him know that there's darkness everywhere, but light is going to come. And then the bear falls asleep in his dad's arms. And that's how it ends. And I don't know. I mean, probably from that description, you can tell that this book, it's just really the best of children's bedtime books. We loved it very much. I recommend it to you and your little ones. Can't You Sleep, Little Bear by Martin Waddell.
I had not made the connection. I loved that book, and I, you know, you don't always look at the authors of children's books. I had not made the connection between that and Owl Babies. Martin Waddell, my new favorite guy.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to recommend, well, I'm not quite going to recommend My Little Pony, the movie, which as I may have mentioned, I happened to see at a preview screening in Times Square on Sunday.
Yeah. I feel like you might have mentioned that.
I think I may have mentioned that on this episode. but I am going to recommend the My Little Pony Friendship is Magic universe more broadly, which I've had to do a bit of research in order to write this review. I've had to watch some episodes of the show. I was already familiar with it because Eliza has been quite interested in it for a while. It's easy to dismiss because it's based on little pastel-colored horse toys that were around since 1982. And yet this present incarnation of the show, which launched in 2010, is in a lot of ways, I think, quite valuable, and I end up feeling quite grateful for it. What's useful about it is it's about six characters, all of whom are female. I want to say girls or women, but their age isn't quite nailed down. And then also they are horses. But they're all female, and yet they all have very distinct, sharply drawn personalities in a way that you rarely see with like groups of female characters in popular culture. We're all used to the thing where there's like the smart boy, the fast running athlete boy, and the goofy, funny boy, and the girl. And that's how the girl is characterized, as the girl. My Little Pony Friendship is Magic is all about very sharply drawn female characters, and it's all about the network of relationships between them and about the interpersonal conflicts and the ways in which they negotiate and repair those conflicts. And it's pitched for kids, but those interpersonal dynamics are done with a measure of sophistication, and I think in a way that is helpful for my 6-year-old daughter, and also I think for a lot of kids, that it takes their peer group relationships very seriously and shows how they can be navigated, repaired, improved, worked on, but not in a didactic way, in a funny and entertaining way. So I am going not quite full brony, but half brony. and I am going to recommend My Little Pony Friendship is Magic.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go full brony and back up this recommendation on the following information. One is that my daughter watched this show well into her double-digit years, and I take both my kids pretty seriously as media critics. And Georgia was like, "Dad, you got." I would sort of like make a little snide comment as I passed through the room. You know, she'd be watching it, and she was like, "Dad, this show is actually really good. Like, I know that it doesn't look like it's really good, but it's really good. You should watch it." And I sat down and watched a few episodes with her, and I was like, "Huh." This show is actually really good. And it's everything that you said. It's also, just for those behind-the-scene nerds, this is a show created and animated by Lauren Faust, who was an animator and one of the co-conspirators around Powerpuff Girls, and who's also married to and partnered with Craig McCracken, who created Powerpuff Girls. My Little Pony Magic, what's it called? Magic? Friendship
Magic. Is Magic.
Friendship is magic, dude.
Friendship is magic.
My Little Pony Friendship is Magic is literally a quality show. And that comes from me, Gabe, and most importantly, from none other than my brilliant daughter, Georgia, who watched it well into her double-digit years.
All right, I guess we're going full brony. This show is full brony. And that's our show. If you have a question that you would like us to tackle, give us a call at 424-255-7833. You can let us know what you thought of the show and of our parenting techniques on our Facebook page, facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. This episode was produced by Benjamin Frisch. Rebecca Lavoie will be back next week for Carvel Wallace. I'm Gabriel Roth, and we will see you next time on Mom and Dad Are Fighting. Well, she was-